notice it when you turn on your faucet today, but global fresh water supplies are in serious peril from global warming and environmental degradation. Joining me now to talk about the dangerous situation is Dr. Peter Glick, the president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, a nonpartisan research institute, and one of the world's leading water experts. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
A recent report by the World Economic Forum claims that the world water bubble is close to bursting. What are water bubbles? Is this at all similar to economic bubbles like the dot-com and housing bubbles?
Well, I think the recent financial crisis and all of the discussion about the financial bubbles that we've all been going through has encouraged many people in the water world to talk about the water crisis, which has been with us, frankly, far longer than the financial crisis, and hopefully will address in the future, to talk about water problems as a water bubble as well. So in a sense, it's a way to describe the many different crises that we face around global fresh water resources.
And where in the world are the worst water bubbles located?
Well, there are all sorts of water problems. We in the United States are relatively well blessed with not just pretty abundant water, but a pretty sophisticated water system that delivers reliable, high-quality water to our taps every day whenever we want it for a pretty low price. But there's still a billion people worldwide that don't have access to safe drinking water. 2.5 billion people, probably 40% or so of the world's population, that doesn't have access to adequate sanitation services that are things that you and I and probably all of our listeners take pretty much for granted. And that's a serious problem all by itself.
But even in your state, in California, you're in Oakland in Northern California, but in the South, aren't there real water problems?
Yes, no, absolutely. The interesting thing, the challenging thing really, is that even places that used to think they had enough water are running up against limits now for the first time. Obviously, the Western United States is much drier than the Eastern United States, but we've acted as though there was plenty of water here. We develop our cities and we grow our lawns and we waste water as effectively as anybody else.
And it spurred economic growth in Southern California, didn't it?
Well, without a doubt, the big cities of the Southwest, Los Angeles, Albuquerque, Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas, couldn't have existed without the massive investment in infrastructure to bring water to them, because there's just not enough water locally to meet their needs. And, of course, you know, we invested a huge amount of money in New York City to bring water from upstate New York to satisfy the big concentrated populations that we have. But we're running up against limits. Atlanta's a good example, you mentioned. They never used to think there was a water problem in Atlanta. It's the Southeast. It rains all the time. But even in the Southeast, we're now seeing constraints on water that we never saw before.
You recently attended the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Did you get the sense that the leaders there fully grasp the emerging water problem that you're describing?
As you may know, Davos is sort of a strange thing. It's been going on for many years. It's a place where world economic leaders and world political leaders get together to talk about politics and economics, and it's a fairly tony event. And the truth is, until recently, they haven't known that they've had to address these broader environmental issues that are beginning to affect all of us. And now I think for the first time, there is a little bit of effort to think about how water affects economics, how water affects public well-being, how political systems and businesses in turn affect water resources. There is a growing understanding of how important water is to all of us. There was, as you might imagine, a huge amount of discussion about the financial crisis and a little bit of an attempt by some of those at Davos who don't really want to talk about the environment not to talk about it. But I think it's inevitable that integrating environmental issues and sustainability issues into some of these discussions is where we're going.
Well, oil becomes a big issue when we talk about financial matters. And you've done work on peak water. Is the concept similar to peak oil?
Yes, it is, and it is, and it isn't. The concept of peak oil is that we will eventually see a decline in the global production of oil as we've tapped into most of the easily, cheaply accessible resources. And in fact, the truth is, in the United States, we passed peak oil in 1970. That was the year of maximum oil production in the United States, and it's declined ever since because we're running out of it.
Well, water is a renewable resource, isn't it? Doesn't nature recycle it?
Yes, we will never run out of water the way we will run out of oil, with some exceptions that maybe I'll describe in a minute. But we are running out of easily and cheaply accessible water. And in many parts of the world, we're reaching something that we call peak ecological water. That is, we're reaching a point where our use of another unit of water actually causes more damage to the environment than it provides benefit to us. So our use of more and more water actually causes more and more harm. And we see that in places like the western United States, where many of the fisheries are threatened, where salmon runs are going extinct. We see it in the Everglades, where clearly we're using too much water to sustain that wonderful ecosystem. We've seen it in the Aral Sea in the former Soviet Union, where all 24 endemic species of fish have gone extinct because of agricultural practices that have basically taken all of the water.
My guest is Dr. Peter Glick, the president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, which is a nonpartisan research institute. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, much of what I've read suggests that there are links between this problem and the world's great rivers, especially in Asia, but also the Nile, the Amazon, perhaps the Mississippi.
Well, part of the discussion about peak ecological water, or even peak water itself, is directly related to the fact that many of our major rivers are endangered and threatened. We see the Colorado River, which flows through seven states in the western U.S. and then into Mexico, dries up before it reaches the end. Basically, the U.S. and Mexico together, mostly the U.S., of course, consume all of the water that used to flow in the Colorado. And so the delta at the mouth of the Colorado is drying up, and the fisheries there are dying. The Yellow River in China no longer reaches the sea during parts of the year because of excessive use of that river. The Aral Sea, which I already mentioned, is at the end of the Amu Darya and the Sir Darya rivers, and it's drying up because of human use. We see contamination in the Mississippi, which is a massive river. You know, you think, well, we couldn't possibly harm a river as big as the Mississippi. It's one of the biggest in the world. But the water quality in the Mississippi is contaminated by industrial runoff and by agricultural runoff. So, yeah, part of the water challenge that faces us is using the water that we have in a way that doesn't basically harm the environment and ultimately harm ourselves in return.
I've been hearing that a major part of the problem is the melting of the snow caps on mountains and of glacier in general. How much of Asia's water supply starts as glacier runoff on the Tibetan Plateau and in the Himalayas?
Yeah, well, this raises the question of climate change, which of course is a very serious problem, one of the most serious global environmental problems that we face. And in many ways, the climate problem is a water problem. The hydrologic cycle that we all learn about in school, evaporation, the formation of clouds, condensation, precipitation, runoff, that's the hydrologic cycle. And it's also the climate cycle. And so as we change the climate, and we're already seeing evidence of this, we will also change where water falls, the quality of water, snowfall versus rainfall ratios. And as you describe, one of the most significant impacts of climate change is actually going to be the loss of snowpack in mountains. In the western United States, where I am, much of our water supply comes from snow that falls in the winter months in the Sierra Nevadas and in the Rocky Mountains. In Asia, much of their water supply falls as snow in the Himalayas and then runs off in the warmer seasons. The Tibetan Plateau is a special case. The Tibetan Plateau is the headwaters in many ways of most of the major rivers of China, the Mekong, the Salween, the Yellow, the Yangtze, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, all of the wonderful rivers of Asia pretty much originate as snowfall and glacial runoff in the Tibetan Plateau. And we're seeing right now accelerated melting because of climate change. As the earth warms up, the glaciers are melting faster and faster. And unfortunately, scientists are worried that we're heading for a time when those glaciers are gone in the next coming decades, which will greatly affect the water supply for literally billions of people on the planet.
Is the Chinese government doing anything about the disappearing glaciers in Tibet? And well, can it do anything?
There's not much they can do. Climate change is a global problem. They can't slow the rate of melting. And as you probably know, that the Chinese are building coal plants enormously quickly to satisfy their energy demand, which is accelerating the rate of climate change. So I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to get the climate challenge under control before quite a substantial number of irreversible impacts are felt, especially, not exclusively in water, but especially in water.
How much of the problem in China is the melting glaciers, and how much of it is the dumping of pollutants in the rivers and lakes?
Well, China has, unfortunately, a huge number of water problems. The challenges in the Tibetan Plateau with climate change are, frankly, at the moment, a small fraction of the water problems in China. China has enormous overconsumption of water. They have, like many places around the world, badly distributed water resources. They don't have that much in the north around Beijing. They have a lot in the south, just as water resources are unevenly distributed in the United States and elsewhere. So they have water scarcity problems in many parts of the country, and it's worsened. Their water scarcity problems are worsened by the fact that they have vast contamination problems. Their industries are not as well regulated as in Europe and the United States. Sewage is dumped uncontrolled in many rivers. So part of their water quantity problem is actually a water quality problem, where they just have failed to address, to the degree we've partly addressed, water treatment and water quality.
How do their problems compare to the situations in the sources of the Nile or the Amazon?
Well, the Nile is an interesting problem. The Nile is shared by 10 nations in the world. We tend to think of it as an Egyptian river, and Egypt is almost completely dependent on flows in the Nile, flows that originate in countries upstream of Egypt. There's less of a quality problem in the Nile than a quantity problem. Egypt's a big country. They have a very large and rapidly growing population, which is true in much of the Middle East. And there's growing demands upstream of Egypt. So Egypt is very worried politically that the other countries upstream, Ethiopia, Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, that share the Nile, are going to want more of the water that flows through their countries.
Well, how have they affected their water supply with the building of the Aswan Dam?
Well, the Aswan Dam, of course, built many, many decades ago, evened out the flows of the Nile. The Nile, like many rivers, is a variable river. It flows very intensely in floods in parts of the year and flows drop during dry parts of the year. And what the Aswan Dam has done is it's a massive storage reservoir, and it stores the flood flows, which they now parcel out month by month for irrigation in Egypt. And so it's helped them improve their irrigation throughout the year, although it's had enormous ecological impacts on the quality of the soils, on the delta around Alexandria. It's a good example of the way humans have modified the natural hydrologic cycle.
Hasn't most of the Andean ice cap melted as well? What effect will that have on South America?
Most of the ice caps are still in place on the high mountains. What we're seeing is, as the Earth warms, is a slow rise in the snow line, in a sense, the line above which whatever falls out of the sky is snow versus rain. We're seeing the snow line rising in the Andes and in the Sierras and in the Rockies and in the Himalayas. There is still lots of snow in these mountains, but less and less every year. And the projections are in the coming decades, we'll lose more and more of the snowpack as it either falls as rain and runs off right away or falls as snow and melts earlier. It's going to cause disruptions of our water systems. You know, in California, we've built a massive water system, reservoirs, aqueducts, pipelines, on the assumption that the future climate's going to look like the past. And if there's anything the climate community is telling us, it's that that's not true anymore, that the future's not going to look like the past, and that we had better think about either building things differently or operating what we've built differently. And water managers aren't good at that. They're trained to assume that the future is going to look like the past, and we have to rethink the way we do everything in the water area.
Well, China recently finished building the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River, and that project has been called an ecological catastrophe. Do you agree?
Yes. You know, we do a book every 2 years called The World's Water at the Institute, and it describes a whole range of water issues and provides water data. We've addressed in the latest volume the Three Gorges Dam and what it means for China and for the water systems there. The Three Gorges Dam is literally the largest dam in the world. It's a massive dam on the Yangtze River. It will generate, when it's finally got all of its components put in place, a huge amount of hydroelectricity, which the Chinese believe from an environmental point of view is better than burning coal. And arguably, there's logic to that. But it also causes all sorts of environmental disruptions on the Yangtze River itself. I think without a doubt, a number of species of fish and the Yangtze dolphin and some other unique species found in the Yangtze will probably go extinct because of the disruption of the dam.
And hasn't there been increased seismic activity in the region following the completion of the dam and filling the reservoirs?
Yes,
how can a water reservoir lead to earthquakes?
Yeah, it's sort of an amazing thought, isn't it? But one of the things we learned, frankly, in the United States when we did this in the 60s, was in some places when you build really big reservoirs and you store a lot of water, it's so heavy that it causes seismic shifts. In the Oroville Dam, which is in Northern California, when they built that in the 60s, a major component of California's water system, they found a whole series of small seismic tremors occurred for a number of years after filling that dam. And in China, they're discovering the same thing. Around Three Gorges, following the filling of the dam, there have been a number of relatively small seismic events and some not-so-small landslides because it's a very steep area where this reservoir has been built. So building a dam has all sorts of, you know, it has positive impacts and it has negative impacts. And, you know, the net result of Three Gorges, whether you think it's good or bad on net, partly depends on how you value extinction versus hydropower versus navigation versus flood control, all of the different things that big dams produce.
My guest is Dr. Peter Glick, president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, which is a research institute that, in this case, looks into water supply. We've been talking about the problems of melting glaciers and snowcaps. What about aquifers? Aren't they a major source of water?
Indeed. A lot of the water that humans use comes from underground, from groundwater aquifers. And actually, this gets back to your earlier question about peak water. Water is a renewable resource in general, and so obviously we'll never run out of it. But there are a number of aquifers, groundwater basins, that are not really renewable, that are in many ways much like oil. They're recharged very, very slowly. They're in dry regions, or where humans pump them faster than nature recharges them. And in those regions, and parts of California fall into this area, the Ogallala Aquifer under parts of the Great Plains, parts of northern China, parts of India, there are many places where humans pump groundwater out for use much faster than it's naturally recharged. And in those basins, we really do see peak water, just like peak oil. We can use it for a while, and then eventually groundwater levels start to drop. It becomes more and more expensive to pump it, and production ultimately declines, just like peak oil.
Well, tapping into one of the largest aquifers under Long Island is banned under state law, so that, I'm quoting, it may be preserved for future generations. Are people putting moratoriums on other aquifers? Is this a feasible approach?
Well, that gets to the critical question of, frankly, how we manage our water resources.
Should we be charging more for it? Is that a way to resolve some of this problem?
Yes. Smart economics is definitely one answer to addressing some of these water problems. But in the western United States and in California, in Texas, for example, in particular, there's no groundwater law. Basically, if you want groundwater, you drill a well and you can pump it. And if there's no cost other than the cost of pumping it itself, you know, there's no dollar per gallon fee on these water resources. And frankly, there's no monitoring of them either. And so what we get is what's classically called a tragedy of the commons. That is, the more people who put their straws into those groundwater aquifers, the faster those levels go down. And it's very hard in the western U.S. and in other parts of the world to regulate a resource that's never been regulated before. And that makes it very hard to use it sustainably in the long run.
You've written about a hard path and a soft path in water policy. What are they?
Well, I think what we need to move toward is what I call the soft path, which I'll describe in a second. But the contrast is the hard path. And what that really means is that in the 20th century, we thought about our water problems as a problem of supply. We assume that the more and more people and a stronger and stronger economy would demand ever more water, and that the answer was simply to figure out how to supply that water. And so in order to supply that water, we built things. We built dams. We built aqueducts to move water from one place to another, Northern California to Southern California, for example. We drilled more groundwater wells to tap into more and more aquifers. And that brought enormous benefits to us. It actually permitted us to build Los Angeles or New York City or Las Vegas, to bring water to where the demand was. But it also brought some enormous costs, ecological costs, economic costs, political and social costs. The Three Gorges Dam is in many ways the classic example of the hard path, a hard solution to a water problem. I think we have to expand our thinking. I think in the future, we have to move to what I call the soft path. That is, we have to continue to rely on big infrastructure where it's appropriate. But we also need to use, as you mentioned earlier, smart economics. We have to price water properly. We have to develop water markets to permit trading. We have to use water more efficiently. The truth is we use a tremendous amount of water inefficiently. We could do the things we want with much less water. We could grow more food with less water. We could wash our clothes with less water. And so efficiency is part of the soft path.
Now, a listener wonders about the drilling of private wells. People sometimes do that on their private property, especially if they have a farmstead. Should we be controlling that as well? Are we going to start passing laws telling people what they can do on their property?
Well, in places where we have no groundwater law, we see that all the time. And the western U.S. is in a drought right now, and people are drilling wells. That provides them with a short-term solution, but it provides a long-term problem for their neighbors and for the long-term sustainability of the system. In other places, groundwater is pretty well regulated, and if you want to drill a groundwater well, you get together with your neighbors and somebody figures out what the sustainable yield of groundwater is, and you let people use the sustainable yield, the amount of water that is naturally recharged, and that's a reasonable long-term solution. We have to move toward a solution that understands the limits of water resources, how much is available renewably, how to use it sustainably and equitably. So I do believe blind, uncontrolled use of water, whether it's drilling groundwater wells or taking water from rivers and lakes, in the long run isn't really going to solve our problems.
What do you think of the approach that Singapore has instituted?
Well, Singapore is an interesting example. For listeners who aren't familiar, Singapore is a city-state, if you will. It's fairly small in area, and it has very limited water resources. They've been very dependent in the past on water from a neighbor, Malaysia, and they have an agreement for Malaysia to deliver water to them. But that comes with political strings, and Singapore doesn't like those political strings, as one might imagine. So they've done a number of things. First of all, they've invested very heavily in efficiency. They're relatively efficient compared to most of the rest of the world in their water use. The second thing they've done is they've built a state-of-the-art water reclamation and reuse plant that takes wastewater and treats it to incredibly high quality. It basically treats it to potable water quality. And they use that water actually not directly for drinking at the moment, but for certain kinds of industrial uses, certain kinds of commercial uses, for flushing toilets, that kind of thing. And the third thing they've done is they've built a desalination plant. These things are very expensive. They're technologically feasible, but when you have few options, you basically move up the cost curve. You're willing to pay more and more for high-quality, reliable water, and that's really what Singapore has done, and I think other parts of the world are going to be doing that as well.
President Obama is spending $2 billion in drinking water projects and $4 billion in wastewater projects. Is that enough?
It's not enough, but it's a start. A lot of the money that we spend on our water systems is local money. It doesn't necessarily have to be federal money. But we've built a wonderful water system in the United States. You know, 100 years ago, cholera, dysentery, typhoid were rampant in the United States because we didn't have a good water quality system. We didn't have a good drinking water system. And we spent the money necessary to provide high-quality potable tap water at very low cost to our big cities. And cholera disappeared, typhoid disappeared, We need to continue to invest in that system to maintain the quality of our tap water system so that people believe that it's good, so that people know that it's good and believe that it's good and don't move away from our tap water system. So the money that we need to spend to upgrade pipes and build state-of-the-art wastewater treatment plants, I think that's an investment that is well worth it.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Dr. Peter Glick, the president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute.
Thanks for having me on.